Professor Lewis. Liza is going to start with a reading. What I want to say about Liza is that while she does have a day job at Travelers Insurance, her heart is with the Muslim Educational Trust, and the and I have it here. I just can't find it. She's a member of the Bilal Mosque and also of the Institute of Christian Muslim Understanding. What she loves doing and spends a lot of time doing is engaging in interfaith dialogue to increase awareness about all faiths in our local community. And we are so pleased to have her with us this morning. Welcome, Liza Leor.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for giving me this opportunity today to talk to you. I'll greet you with the Arabic greeting. We say, Assalamu alaikum. May peace be on all of you. And since Suleyma asked me to talk about hope today, I have chosen two different verses from the Quran that I would like to share with you that talk about hope. And if you can hear me clearly, if you can't hear me clearly, please let me know if my voice is too low. Is this okay? Speak more in the microphone. Is that better? Okay. All right. So I will start in Arabic, and then I will translate, like we say, interpretation as close as we can to the meaning. A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. قُلْ يَا عِبَادِيَ الَّذِينَ أَسْرَفُوا عَلَىٰ أَنفُسِهِمْ لَا تَقْنَطُوا مِنْ رَحْمَةِ اللَّهِ إِنَّ اللَّهَ يَغْفِرُ الذُّنُوبَ جَمِيعًا إِنَّهُ هُوَ الْغَفُورُ الرَّحِيمُ. This is the first verse. It says, "Say, O my servants who have transgressed against their souls, do not despair of God's mercy, for God is most forgiving and most merciful." And the second verse in the Quran that I chose to share with you today says, فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ أُسْرِ فَإِنَّمَا الْأُسْرِ يُسْرًا إِنَّمَا الْأُسْرِ يُسْرًا. It's a passage, it's a two verses from the Quran that says the same thing for the repetition to highlight that how important it is for us to know. And it means, surely with every difficulty there is ease. Surely with every difficulty there is ease. To me, that's a message of hope from the Quran, because first, the verse that I shared with you says that no matter how you see yourself, at what state in your life you are, never despair that the mercy of God is away from you. It's always present next to you. The way I personally understand this verse is my own interpretation, my personal understanding is that it's my consciousness of the mercy of God that is in flux all the time. It shifts away. The mercy is ever present and God is ever present next to me. It's kind of like being aware of the air. We don't think about the air around us all the time, but we're breathing it in. But just because we forget that there is air around us, it doesn't cease to exist around us. And God's mercy is similar to that, where it's always ever present around us. It's us who are always in flux with the consciousness of it and how we are aware of it at any given time. So that's the that was the verse that I wanted to share from the Quran. The other, relating with the message of hope, the story among the prophetic traditions that we share with the biblical stories also is the story of, the story mainly of Joseph, but he's the son of Jacob. And the hope is coming from how Jacob reacts to the events that unfold in the story of life of Joseph, basically. And I find Jacob in that story as a character. Quran, just as a side note, Quran is a whole chapter named after Joseph, which is uniquely different from the chapters because the way Quran is written does not chronologically present itself similar to Old Testament biblical stories. For example, Moses' story is the most common theme in the Quran, but it's spread all over the whole book of Quran, as you see this rather large book. However, Joseph is unique in its story in the Quran is because there is one specific chapter named after Joseph, and his story is chronologically told from start to finish, from his young youth age when he's still with Jacob, all the way to him and his family moving and immigrating to Egypt. So it's a unique story. If you ever get a chance to read the story of Joseph in the Quran, I highly recommend it because it's one story that actually chronologically makes sense to a new reader. But what I found in the story of Joseph is how hopeful Jacob is throughout the time. And it's not a short time. It's a long time. And forgive me if I'm telling this story to people who are not aware of it, but we grew up learning as, biblical or Quranic stories as even children, just like Noah's Ark. Joseph is a story of his brothers being not nice to him and all that. But the unrelenting hope of Jacob is what I just wanted to remind you all that I find inspirational for myself, is that the dad who loves, as a parent myself, I can relate to Jacob's love for Joseph, who has now gone away. And the first time that his sons come back and tell him that, according to Quranic story, the brothers come back and tell Jacob that Joseph was eaten by wolves and he's no longer there. And Jacob's response is that I will be patient, as patience is beautiful, and God will help me. Only God can help me in this situation. So there is not just lesson of hope, but also the fact that how Jacob reacts towards his other children. He loves Joseph, but he also loves the other boys who are coming back to him and telling him that, sorry, Joseph was eaten by wolves. And it's his reaction that kind of guides me also as a parent, too, when he hears that really sad and terrible news from his boys that Joseph is no longer there. But also he continues. His faith is, to me, what gives him this unrelenting hope that he will one day will see Joseph. And there is a plan that God has in place that will unfold itself in the time that God wants it to unfold. And it gives me the courage and strength to go on in the times that things look very bleak and seems like nothing we can do to make things better. One thing that growing up in age gives you is the idea how small your circle of influence is, but also how strong it can be. Back when I was young and new in this country and I was 22 years old, I used to think that I could change all the community here or impact them or somehow make them see and become more aware and or maybe change things back home somehow. And as you grow up, you eventually realize that there is a sphere of influence that each one of us has. And it, while it may not reach, you know, across the oceans and to another country and affect other people, but you do have each one of us has an important circle of influence. Everybody around us, the new people we meet, the old friends we have, the family members we have, and that's a powerful circle of influence that each of us can impact it with our behavior and keep that hope alive that whichever person we can impact has a positive interaction with us. So that's what I get. And towards the end, again, coming back to Jacob's story, at the very end of the story, the way the Quran tells the story is that when there is famine in Palestine and Jacob's sons go to Egypt because they have still food available to give out to people. So they go there and Joseph manages to keep Benjamin there, his youngest brother, the youngest brother of the 12. And Benjamin stays there and he says, you need to go back to your father and tell them that Benjamin is not coming with you. So they go back and tell Jacob, now Benjamin is no more. And at that time in the story, the way Quran tells us, the brothers don't know Joseph is Joseph. They don't know yet. They have not recognized him because so many years have passed and he's a grown man now. So they don't know that it's Joseph who's holding back Benjamin. But now Benjamin is being held back by Joseph. And all the other 10 boys come back and tell the brother, come back and tell Jacob that, well, the person is in charge in Egypt has kept Benjamin. So, first Joseph and now Benjamin. But even at that time, this is the response that Jacob gives. He says, go find Joseph and Benjamin. And never give up hope in God's mercy. Only the people who do not have faith despair. This is at the time where so many years have passed, and in the times and the situation where Jacob is living in, it seems impossible for him to be saying that he still is looking for Joseph after all these years, where his brothers met him and did not recognize him. That's how much time has passed. But he's still keeping that hope alive because of the faith in God that he has. And I think that is, to me, that's the ultimate story of hope and keeping the hope alive. And some things that, some other thoughts that I wanted to share with you all in terms of keeping the hope alive, talking about the situation and I've been thinking the world we live in is in a situation right now, seems like that it's hard to keep the hope alive because of the things the way they are in the Middle East. I'm originally from Pakistan, and the current news that comes from my country is not very hopeful either. But again, coming back to that, you know, our own small circle of influence, what we can do to influence others to keep that hope alive. I think the conditions that we have in the world around us, and some of, unfortunately, in our own country too, stem from fear. They stem from conditioning ourselves as being fearful of all the others, quote unquote. And others can be, you know, defined in so many categories. Others can be people who do not share your faith. Others can be people who do not share your color, your ethnicity, your language, or your country, or there are many forms of others. Sometimes others can go so small as, you know, within my country there are four provinces. Others can be you're from the other province, not mine. It could be that small, even though there's a lot of overlap and there's a lot of similarities, but if you can bring it down to sects within religion, and others can be of the other sect. So others can be of another side. Sometimes I hear people who have lived in Portland all their lives talk about East and West as being the East as being the other side. You know, or you live on the East side of the Levant. So we define others in so many different ways. And one of my good friends, who is also part of Christian Muslim Institute, her name is Nancy Hoff. She recently published a book, and she used to be a writer, religion writer for Oregonian. And I will borrow a phrase that she wrote, and she wrote in her book that strangers mystify us, but they help us figure out who we are. And I thought that was really timely quote, because we're so many ways defining others in these days in all kinds of narratives, whether it be political, religious, or economic, or ethnic. And one thing that I feel that my work of interfaith has shown me is that when you show that your values of how you define humanity is shared by any of the other that we define as others, once you see that, that's when your perspective changes in your mind, how you see that other. So this is what I try to do, and this is what I would leave you with the message, is that when you find the other, try to find what it is that they value. And you would see more often than not that their values of humanity are very similar to what your value of humanity, justice, and freedom for everybody is. And there will always be differences. I mean, if we didn't have a diverse world, it would be a very boring place to live in. But it's not just tolerating differences, it's more than that. Seeing other people's human values changes how we see them, and it makes it easier to break the barriers that dehumanization of other groups and creating a what the most of the time what the narrative does, and it happens everywhere, it around the world. I grew up in Pakistan, lived there, and we have our neighboring country as, for the most part, our enemy. And it's easier to homogenize a group of people that you don't know and label them as one group that thinks in one way, in a monolithic fashion, and operates in that monolithic fashion. When you go up close, you find, and that was the perspective of the West that most people have in my country. And when I came to live in this country, the first time somebody said, do you know what a Texan, somebody mentioned Texan drawl, and I'm like, people in Texas speak a different language? And they said, no, it's just they have a different accent. To my ear, there was no difference in the accent as the other, as the outsider. And after 20 years of living here, I can tell you the accent in this country now. But that understanding and awareness of diversity comes from getting up close and knowing people. And then you realize that it's not a, United States is not a monolithic group of people who thinks the same and who do everything the same and share the same exact values. That is not the case in our country. And I can tell you that that is also not the case in everywhere in the world, whether it be Middle East or China or Asia. It's not monolithic, but unfortunately, it's easier to lump everybody together and create one narrative for a whole group of people or a whole country or a whole continent. And I think the hope is for my interfaith work is to break down that monolithic version of people in people's mind and have them see people just as diverse as they see themselves as unique and different from other people. So thank you so much for your time.
So we have a good amount of time to engage with Faiza in conversation about interfaith dialogue and how it is and how it works. And let's get started. Put your hand up and I'll bring the mic around and try to get to all of our comments and questions.
Hi, I'm curious about what languages do you personally speak? And I've never quite understood the role of the Arabic language in the Arabic influenced countries. Mm-hmm. So if you could sort of explain that a little bit, it would be nice.
I'm so glad you asked that question because one of the things when I go and speak or talk about Islam, I usually try to remind people that majority of the Muslims are not Arabs. And the biggest population in the world of Muslims is in India and Indonesia, which do not have any Arab culture. There are some common themes in all the Muslim cultures that are related to religious rituals, and everybody shares the same. For example, we at least attempt to pray five times a day. Five times a day prayer is mandatory in Islam. So you can go to Indonesia, Malaysia, or Saudi Arabia, and you will find mosques that have prayers five times a day. That is common across all Muslim countries. However, people in Malaysia and Indonesia do not dress the same as people in Pakistan or India or Saudi Arabia or Iraq or other places. And they don't eat the same food. Their weddings are not the same. Their cultural norms are not the same. So there is a huge amount of diversity across the Muslim world. As far as my personal language and ethnic background is concerned, I grew up in Pakistan, and Pakistan has only been in existence for about 70 years. We were also, like the United States, a British colony for about 150 years prior to that, and it was all considered subcontinent of India. There is a huge diversity in terms of ethnic and cultural identities within India and Pakistan. As I said, Pakistan has four provinces, and we have multiple languages even within the small country. Pakistan is slightly bigger than California in terms of its size, but we have 180 million people. Yeah. We have multiple languages across those provinces, and I grew up speaking within India, there is a common language called Hindi, and in Pakistan, we speak a variant of that called Urdu, which is basically a language that came out of for the need to communicate across these cultural ethnicities. India, of course, you know, has, I think, 30 states, or I don't know how many, but they have, like, so hundreds of languages within India across the region. And so as a way to fulfill a need to communicate with each other, Urdu and Hindi both are very similar to each other, and they arose from Persian, Sanskrit, and Arabic, a combination of those and some of the local languages. So I grew up speaking that, but also being exposed to the other four provincial languages that we have in our country. After I came here to the United States as a student, and I was able to read and write English, but was not speaking it all the time back home. So I would call myself a fluent English speaker. And then I, later on, I got a chance to learn Hebrew because I was fortunate to live in Israel for 2 years. So I learned to thrive on the streets with enough Hebrew to ask my way out.
Thank you for coming and talking. My experiences with other languages have been really mind expanding and life expanding, and my son is now dating somebody who the family is Honduran and Mexican, and seeing him interact with them and getting to interact with their family and realizing that I need to speak Spanish makes that, you know, that 30% that I understand really, you know, count. And it was a great interaction, and to see my son treated seriously and not just, oh, this is a language I have to learn for school. I mean, really embracing being bilingual is very exciting. Do you have that same feeling about, you know, your daughters when they're bilingual, when you see them learning different languages?
Yes, and also it's a challenge because one of the difficulties of living in a one language environment is that it's hard to keep the other languages alive. So it's a challenge. I talk to my daughter in my language and they answer me back in English, and it's a reminder constantly to ask them to try to at least speak our language. But language, I mean, it's an important point that you raise. Language is also another factor in becoming the other that I was talking about. If you do not speak the language of a group, then it's easier for them to see you as the other. I see that as an immigrant and other immigrants that come to this country. I see that as a, you know, the major barrier for interaction, for making friends, and for being part of the larger community that they come to, is because we tend to see people who don't speak our language as somehow not completely part of us. So I think it's very important to learn, and I'm glad that finally our neuroscientists and our you know, child psychologists are coming to that understanding that actually exposing kids at early on to a different language is easier and better for them, because when I came to this country, it was the educational model was mainly that you get to learn your second language in high school. And I was very surprised at that because I was like, that is way, I mean, I didn't understand why we were teaching kids at high school a brand new language, because when I was going to school back in Pakistan, I was learning my own language, Urdu, that we spoke, and we were taught mathematics and science and English. So besides English as a language art, we learned math and science and English. And then in my area, Karachi is the biggest city in Pakistan where I grew up in. We are in the province that we are. The provincial language was also mandatory for the kids to learn. So I was learning Urdu and English and the mandatory provincial language. Sindh is the province, so their language. Plus, I was learning to read Quran in Arabic, so that was the other language. But as a kindergartner, I never thought that, oh my God, I've been settled with four languages. This is too much.
Hi, Hi, thank you for coming today. You just touched on my question. Excuse me. The Quran is always in Arabic?
The Quran is originally revealed in Arabic. So a little bit of background on Quran. According to our belief, Quran is the original word of God. So the most closest analogy I could draw is the tablet of Moses that were given to him, written by God. So Quran is understood to be the exact word of God that was revealed to Prophet Muhammad in Arabic. We do have lots of commentaries and translations of the Quran, but the original Arabic is what we believe is preserved ever since 1400 years ago when it was revealed. So when we read the verses of the Quran, those are considered to be the actual word of God. And then because they're in Arabic, me included, most of us are, taking the interpretation and the meaning in different languages. I have several Qurans that are written in my language, Urdu, and then also in English. This one that I use is an English interpretation. So because I'm not, Arabic is not my first language, and even though I know how to read Arabic, I'm not that fluent in Arabic to understand all the whole Quran with its meaning without looking at the interpretation. So that is the added help.
Thank you so much for being here. You just opened my eyes to something that is, it just seems like it should be so obvious, and yet it isn't. Just to give you a little bit of context, I'm a first-generation American. My parents immigrated from Germany. Even my older brother was born in Germany. We were the foreigners that people stared at in the grocery store because we're speaking a foreign language, German in our case. We also grew up in the South. We're integrated with African Americans, and it was just normal. And we were struck when we moved to Oregon how white
it is.
And it was actually quite a shocker. And then we also were involved in something called the Cyprus Friendship Program, which brings teenagers from the Greek and the Turkish side of Cyprus, and brings those teenagers together to try to build these friendships between those two sides. And we actually took our family to Cyprus to meet those families. And all these things you think would prime me to have this understanding of foreign cultures and understanding of race. I am struck by how hard it is, even with all of that context, to not feel this other around other people. And we feel bad right now in some ways that we're raising our children in Oregon, where there is so lack of other, and it really is a concern of ours for how we're raising our children. And the one thing that you said that really struck home is how we do have a divided America, but that's true of every culture.
Yeah.
Every single culture has different perspectives. Like, you can't just say Germans are German,
right?
British, Britain. Yeah, like every single culture has
its own diversity.
Its own diversity.
Yeah.
And why do we not see that? Why do we not see that there are people just like us in every culture in the world? And then of course there are people who have views that we don't share in every culture in the world. And it just seems like it's so obvious, and it's something that you said that really struck home. It seems so obvious when you say that, and yet why is that not how we interpret the world? And it's pretty clear that we don't. It really struck me that that's true, and I think that's something that I think we should try to figure out how to share that perspective more. And I thank you for opening my eyes to that perspective.
Well, I'm so appreciative that you share this sentiment because, you know, you realize that even if you are first-generation immigrant, you feel like you're more primed than other people. But it doesn't happen because, as I mentioned, I got to live in Israel for 2 years, and I experienced the other all over again being there. But we do tend to, you know, go to our comfort zones and stick to our people. Well, something I heard regarding immigration, because that seems to be our topic in the country these days, is that every wave of immigrants that come to this country, when we have polled in the past even 100 years, we have, every time we ask people, the people who are already in are okay with no more coming in. And that is not unique to the United States. I was thinking about Indian history, and India has been a
you know, an economic hub, and even in, since the time of Alexander, has been raided by people who are coming in from the outside. It has been invaded in the history over and over again. And people come from, you know, all kinds, Central Asia, Europe, and even from China's side for the economic resources that India has to offer. But if you look at it, over every wave that comes in, it makes it its own. And then, you know, 1,000 years later, any new invaders are seen as the outsider, and we are the indigenous people. And 2,000 years later, this history repeats itself. So I think we have this trait built in into us as to, you know, take on the identity of the place and call ourselves the indigenous people of that place. And then, you know, when new people come in, we're like, they are the others. So it's I think it's a constant struggle that we humans have against our own self, to go against our that instinct that, no, this is us and they are them, and then transcend that is, I think transcending that is a challenge.
Right, you don't want to close the door after you arrive.
Yeah.
I think you said at one point the experience with the other clarifies your own values, that experience. I'll tell you a short story. We have hosted students for many years. We had a girl from Greenland live with us, and she seemed very friendly. We emailed. When she got to our home and was living with us, we discovered she didn't have the gift of conversation. She was like a ghost. And I found myself really very angry that she wouldn't engage in conversation with anyone. It wasn't like obstinance, it was simply that wasn't her way of communicating. In the end, she went to another family with smaller children where she would be sort of caught up in the rough and tumble. But what it brought to light in my mind was how my family values communication, and particularly talking as a bond. And I hadn't, I mean, it was like the air I breathe. Talking is so important. So I'm curious, in your case, when you were confronted, or when you were dealing with being the other or experiencing the other, what of your own values came to light more clearly?
That's a great question. Actually, I am so grateful and thankful for coming to this country, not because, you know, I got an education, but I don't think that had I continued to live in my country, that my own identity and who I was would have been so clear to me. So that is my biggest gain out of living with the other. It's because when I came, I went to Washington State University, and I spent as little time as I could in Poland, because I came from a big city like New York and ran away from it. But when you are an immigrant in this country, especially in this Northwest area where you look different from the rest, everybody asks you, so where are you from? And that question was so often repeated that it generated this thought process in my mind, like, so where am I from and who am I and how do I define myself to the other? And that actually made me start thinking of who I was. And that's why I said I don't think I would be the person I am today that I lived in my country, in terms of my own identity, in terms of my own space. Because one of the things that living in a homogenous group does to you is that you never question who you are, because everybody is just like you. And you kind of just do what everybody does, because you're following along the same group. And you never question why you're doing something that you're doing. And once I started reading the Quran more closely after coming to this country, in search of my own identity, one recurring theme from the prophetic traditions that I found was that every prophet, and most of them are these Old Testament biblical prophets, when they go to the people and say, believe in one God and believe in the oneness of God and don't worship in the manner you do worship to the idols, their answer is a unique answer to every prophet. It's not just one. There is one common answer that occurs over and over again, that the people said, you want us to abandon our forefathers' ways, and the generations that passed before us have done it this way. How can we abandon that? How could they be wrong? And that was the question, that was the recurring theme that the Quran actually squarely goes against and says, that should not be the reason to believe, because their forefathers did it, or everybody around you does it. So one of the things that when I talk to my girls, I say, don't ever do something because others are doing it. Don't ever stop doing it because nobody is doing it. You should have your own reason for doing things and not doing things. So I think that my biggest gift of being with the other is finding my own self in my identity.
You sort of come to where I was going to comment. When you first came in you and talking about Quran, you're with most of the world, I think, in that there is a God, Yahweh, Allah, G-O-D if you want.
Right.
I kind of prefer the force,
uh-huh.
if you want, or entropy. And here in this church, I think more people are along that line rather than a God that you would pray to and who's going to do something good for you. I think that's a big gap. And the Unitarian group here, I've heard people talk, it's mostly about how we behave with each other.
Right.
And the word God, the G word, mm-hmm. is very seldom used in this group. Whereas coming from Islam, you're talking very much about our main duty is to God. And that's a whole different focus, as I see it.
I agree with you on the part of the force. Definitely we consider God the most powerful. So the force is a shared theme there. However, the verse I chose, it's in the very beginning, says that God is merciful if you have transgressed against your soul. So it's not a transgression against God. One thing that I think that I have personally understood from the message of Quran, and you're right, we do have our concept of God is a living being who does control everything that he has created. However, the actions that we take on this earth are meant to benefit us or meant to transgress against our soul. So it's whatever our actions is, they either benefit us or not, and it does not impact God in any way. So God was there before we were here, and God will be there after we're gone. And anything that we do does not affect God in a positive or negative way. There is no gain or loss when it comes to God the way we understand Him. What the message of the Quran is how we behave in this society while we are here towards each other, towards ourselves. And one of the main ideas or the concept of Islam is everybody says Islam means peace. But the way I understand it is that it is the peace that comes from the submission, and that submission leads towards certain actions towards your own self and towards others around you that creates that peace. It's not just automatic Islam and peace, you know. It is a result of specific actions towards yourself and towards your community that creates that peace. And that is what the guidance out of the Quran, at least in my understanding, should result into. Now, is that something that we can achieve in this world? I don't know that. But that is the call that Quran has.
Great. Thank you so much.